Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons. I'm your host, Kerry Parker. Today we have episode 367 for March 11th, 2024. Got a new show for you this week. Plenty of topics to cover. Real quick before I do, because I know I mentioned this recently after the AT&T outage, I was dead serious. I was looking about getting a ham radio license for years. It's been kind of on my geeky bucket list. And hey, just this morning, I took and passed the Technician Classic radio exam. That is the first level for ham radio amateur usage the FCC requires in the U.S. So, you know, hey, I finally got that done. For some reason you're interested in that, you know, hey, shoot me an email. Maybe someday I'll have a rig powerful enough to go to reach wherever you might be. Also, I am putting the finishing touches on a new promotion for patrons, both new and existing. I still have a few things to line up with some potential sponsors. It's taken a little bit longer than I thought, but the basic idea is there, but I want to make sure I get all my ducks in a row before I give you too much more information. However, I am also thinking about giving away some of my super cool security-enhancing Dragon Challenge coins. I haven't given those out in a long time, and they're sitting here ready, waiting to go, and this would be a great time to do that. So I will probably be lumping that in with this promotion as well. So stay tuned. Hopefully I will have this ready to roll out sometime in the next few weeks. All right. So again, we have a new show for you today. We're going to talk about how the FBI is starting to use push alerts to catch suspects. We talked recently about how push alerts were a privacy problem. And apparently this has been something that law enforcement has been using for many years now. If you own a Roku branded television, you may have recently been served a pop-up message saying that you have to accept their new terms of service before you can use the device. I'll tell you a little bit more about what's behind that. Consumer Reports just did a study about video doorbells and how many of them have really bad security. NPR has a story about artificial intelligence being used to locate photos, like by looking at what's in the background of photos you post. It does an amazingly good job of figuring out pretty close to where you actually are when that photo was taken. There's a story in Ars Technica, I think this was at a Canadian university, about an error message that popped up on a vending machine that gave away the fact that that vending machine was using facial recognition on people who used it without their consent or knowledge. The Markup has a pretty disturbing story about what could be happening with your sensitive data when a data broker goes bankrupt. Lifehacker has a very interesting article about your information that is publicly available, what kind of information is out there, and you might be surprised, and what you can do about it. Privacy for Cars just highlighted a very interesting law in New Jersey that requires dealerships to at least offer to wipe your car's data when you turn it in from a lease or trade it in or something like that. Proton Mail is now offering simple email alias opportunities. I'm sure using its simple login acquisition under the covers. I'll tell you how that works. The Canadian Supreme Court has now ruled that police need a warrant to get a person's IP address. The U.S. is cracking down further on predatory spyware firms. The iPhone spyware company NSO has suffered a major defeat in court that will allow Meta to see all of its source code. And I've got my tip of the week, which I was kind of triggered by this notice from Authy, who is shutting down its desktop app. This is a two-factor authentication app. They want you basically to focus on using your mobile device instead of the desktop app. But it led me to think about how we need to be backing up our two-factor authentication seed codes. And I'll tell you what I mean by that in the tip of the week. So lots to get to. Let's get started. All right, first up, this is from the Washington Post. The alleged pedophile Love 'Em Young. Oh, God, that just makes me throw up a little in my mouth just to read that. That's this person's online handle. Anyway, this pedophile with this horrible username had worked to stay anonymous in the chat rooms where he bragged about sexually abusing children. A criminal affidavit said he covered his tracks by using TeleGuard, an encrypted Swiss messaging app, to share a video of himself last month with a, I'm not even going to read it, but the FBI has a new strategy. A foreign law enforcement officer got Telegard to hand over a small string of code the company had used to send push alerts, the pop-up notifications that announced instant messages and news updates, to the suspect's phone. An FBI agent then got Google to quickly hand over a list of email addresses this month linked to that code, known as a push token, and traced one account to a man in Toledo, an affidavit shows. The man, Michael Aspinwall, was charged with sexual exploitation of minors and distribution of child pornography and arrested within a week of the Google request. The breakthrough relied on a little-known quirk of push alerts, a basic staple of modern phones. These tokens can be used to identify users and are stored on servers run by Apple and Google, which can hand them over at law enforcement's request. But the investigative technique has raised alarms from privacy advocates who worry the data could be used to surveil Americans at a time when police and prosecutors have used cell phone data to investigate women for potentially violating state abortion bans. This is a quote from Cooper Quinton from the EFF. And Coop says, "This is how any new surveillance tool method starts out. The government says we're only going to use this in the most extreme cases to stop terrorists and child predators, and everyone can get behind that. But these things always end up rolling downhill. Maybe a state attorney general one day decides, hey, maybe I can use this to catch people having an abortion. Even if you trust the U.S. right now to use this, you might not trust a new administration to use it in a way you deem ethical," unquote. And obviously, that's not just your government, right? It could be some foreign government or some hacker group. Anyway, back to the article. The data has become prized evidence for federal investigators who have used push tokens in at least four cases across the country to arrest suspects in cases related to child sexual abuse material and a kidnapping that led to a murder, according to a Washington Post review of court records. And law enforcement officials have defended the technique by saying they use court-authorized legal processes that give officers a vital tool that they need to hunt down criminals. The Post found more than 130 search warrants and court orders in which investigators had demanded that Apple, Google, Facebook, and other tech companies hand over data related to a suspect's push alerts, or in which they noted the importance of push tokens in broader requests for account information. Those court documents, which were filed in 14 states as well as the District of Columbia, were related to suspects in a range of criminal charges, including terrorism, sanction evasion, guns, drugs, COVID relief fraud, and Somali piracy. Some of the cases involved the pro-Trump mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. These applications and court orders reviewed by the Post indicate that the investigative technique goes back years. Court orders that were issued in 2019 to Apple and Google demanded that the companies hand over information on accounts identified by push tokens linked to alleged supporters of the Islamic State terrorist group. But the practice was not widely understood until December, when Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, in a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland, said an investigation had revealed that the Justice Department had prohibited Apple and Google from discussing the technique. Apple confirmed the government restriction in a statement that month to the Post, but said it intended to provide more detail about its compliance with the request in an upcoming report now that the method had become public. And we talked about this back when it happened. Basically, Apple was under a gag order about this. And basically, once Ron Wyden made it public, Apple felt that they were released from the order since it was now public information. Google said in a statement then that it shared Wyden's, quote, commitment to keeping users informed about these requests, unquote. Unlike normal app notifications, push alerts, as the name suggests, have the power to jolt a phone awake, a feature that makes them useful for the urgent pings of everyday use. Many apps offer push alert functionality because it gives users a fast, battery-saving way to stay updated, and few users think twice before turning them on. But to send that notification, Apple and Google require the apps to first create a token that tells the company how to find a user's device. Those tokens are then saved on Apple's and Google's servers out of the user's reach. In effect, Wyden said, that technical design made Apple and Google into a digital post office able to scan and collect certain messages and metadata, even of people who wanted to maintain discreet. David LeBeau, a developer and engineer in Paris, wrote last year that the ubiquitous feature had become a privacy nightmare. David Kahn Gilmore, a senior technologist at the American Civil Liberties Union, worried that the range of account information connected to a push token could allow it to be used to uncover other data. Down the road, he said, law enforcement could use the tactic to infiltrate a group chat for activists or protesters whose push tokens might give them away. And this is a quote from Gilmore, quote, "This is not just U.S. law enforcement. This is true of all the other law enforcement regimes around the world as well, including in places where dissent is more heavily policed and surveilled," unquote. So this is classic privacy 101. This is yet another technique that has been used by various people, in this case law enforcement, but it's not going to be just law enforcement. It's going to be hackers. It's going to be foreign governments and other intelligence agencies and groups that you may not agree with, using these same kind of techniques to track people who don't want to be tracked or invade our privacy. Now, you could hope that Apple and Google are keeping this information safe, but I will bet you that there are other ways to get at this information, or at least some portion of this metadata, this important metadata, without having to go directly through Apple and Google. Now, I'm hoping that what this will spark both Apple and Google to do is lock this stuff down and come up with a more privacy-preserving technique to implement this functionality. In the past, that's certainly what they've done, and I expect that they are hard at work on this right as we speak. Obviously, there are good uses for this technology, and this article focuses on several of them. But we can't just lean on those kind of law enforcement arguments for loss of privacy. It's a very, very slippery slope, and we need to keep that broader picture in mind when we think about these sorts of technologies. All right, this next one is from TechCrunch, and this is disturbing, but not unexpected. Roku users around the country turned on their TVs this week to find an unpleasant surprise. The company required them to consent to new dispute resolution terms in order to access their device. The devices are unusable until the user agrees. The terms, of course, include a forced arbitration agreement that prevents the user from suing or taking part in lawsuits against Roku. It's common these days as a way of limiting liability, and users often have little or no recourse. They only find out later when the company does something heinous and consequences are negligible. I try to opt out of these when I can. That's the writer of the article here. And after reading the terms, to which, of course, by continuing to use my TV, I had already agreed, I found out that you could only do so by mailing a written notice to their lawyers, something I fully intend to do today. Actually, since arbitration was apparently already required, this update provides an opportunity to opt out of something I didn't know I was already subject to. But yesterday, I turned on my TV and saw the notice again, as did countless others, who quickly took to the forums to complain. I accidentally agreed, again, I think, by hitting the star button to view the terms and then hitting back, to which I intended to look for a way out, but of course there was none. There was no accessing the device without agreeing to the new terms. Not that this is so uncommon. After all, we constantly are using apps and games that present us with new end-user license agreements and terms of conditions. I probably have ignored a dozen and exposed myself to untold dangers here. But there really is something rather despicable about totally disabling a user's device until they agree and having basically anything the user does count as an agreement. Many phones, apps, and services let you continue using them for some time or restrict you to the current version until you agree. Unfortunately, that isn't the case here. As of right now, I am bound by this new agreement. I'll still be opting out, as you should too, but you'll have to move fast. You can only do so within 30 days of the new terms coming into force upon you. Now, this article goes on a little bit longer. In fact, if you're interested in trying to opt out, and you know what? If you have a Roku TV and this upsets you, I absolutely think you should do this. If nothing else, just to annoy their lawyers. And you can get all the details of how to do this in the article. It's not easy. And in fact, there are laws being bandied about in the U.S. right now that I think are great. The law basically says you have to make it as easy to opt out as it was to opt in. This is the classic gym membership thing where it's really, really easy to sign up and really, really hard to get out of. It's a dark pattern, and a lot of companies use this. It's very easy, and in this case, it's actually impossible not to agree with this before going on, and then to undo that, you have to go through a lot more effort, and that is absolutely positively on purpose. So, making it just as easy to undo something as it was to do something, I think makes perfect sense. I cannot wait for that law to be passed. I hope it does. Now, again, I don't connect my TVs to the internet, period. I do not use the built-in smart technology of any television. My TVs are all dumb. I do not connect them to the internet at all. And you think, well, hey, they're not getting software updates for security. Well, I don't care because they're not connected to the internet at all. They're effectively air-gapped. There's nothing they're going to do to me because they can't communicate, and nobody can communicate with them or I try to hack them. They're off the network. I personally use an Apple TV box for all my streaming and apps and Netflix and all that stuff. And I just completely ignore whatever came with my television, which neatly sidesteps this particular problem. All right, moving on. This is from Consumer Reports. On a recent Thursday afternoon, a Consumer Reports journalist received an email containing a grainy image of herself waving at a doorbell camera she'd set up at her back door. If the message came from a complete stranger, it would have been alarming. Instead, it was from Steve Blair, a CR privacy and security test engineer who had hacked into the doorbell from 2,923 miles away. Blair had pulled similar images from connected doorbells at other CR employees' homes and from a device in our Yonkers, New York testing lab. While we expected him to gain access to these devices, it was still a bit shocking to see photos of the journalist's deck and backyard. After all, video doorbells are supposed to help you keep an eye on strangers at the door, not let other people watch you. Blair was able to capture those images because he and fellow test engineer David Della Rocca had found serious security flaws in this doorbell, along with others sold under different brands but apparently made by the same manufacturer. The doorbells also lack a visible ID issued by the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, that's required by the agency's regulations, making them illegal to distribute in the U.S. Thousands of these video doorbells are sold each month on Amazon and other online marketplaces, including Walmart, Sears, and other global popular marketplaces, Shein and Temu. Experts say they're just a drop in the flood of cheap, insecure electronics from Chinese manufacturers being sold in the U.S. Blair and Della Rocca discovered the problems while evaluating a number of video doorbells for our regular ratings program. They were sold under two brand names, Eken and Tuck, that's E-K-E-N and T-U-C-K. The two devices stood out not just because of the security problems, but also because they appeared to be identical, right down to the plain white box they came in despite having different brand names. Online searches quickly revealed at least 10 more seemingly identical video doorbells being sold under a range of brand names, all controlled through the same mobile app called Aiwit, A-I-W-I-T, which is owned by Eken. We bought two of these products sold under the Fishbot and Rake Blue brands and found the same vulnerabilities. The security issues are serious. People who face threats from a stalker or a estranged abusive partner are sometimes spied on through their phones, online platforms, and connected smart devices. The vulnerabilities Consumer Reports found could allow a dangerous person to take control of the video doorbell on their target's home, watching when they and their family members come and go. First, these doorbells expose your home IP address and Wi-Fi network name to the internet without encryption, potentially opening your home network to online criminals. Security experts worried that there could be more problems, including poor security on the company's servers where videos are being stored. The video doorbells pose a special threat to individuals who are in danger from people who know where they live. Anyone who can physically access one of the doorbells can take over the device. No tools or fancy hacking skills needed. Let's imagine that an abusive ex-boyfriend wants to watch the comings and goings of his former partner and her children. He'd simply need to create an account on the Aiwit smartphone app, then go to the target's home and hold down the doorbell button to put it into pairing mode. He could then connect the doorbell to a Wi-Fi hotspot and take control of the device. As the new quote-unquote owner of the device, he could now watch who comes and goes and when. And he could see the device's serial number. That's dangerous because of the company's poor security systems. When the stalker pairs the device to his phone, the original owner will get an email saying she no longer has access to the device. That might seem like a small technological glitch she can solve by simply repairing the device with her own phone, taking back control. But once the stalker has the serial number, he can continue to remotely access still images from the video feed. No password is needed, or even an account with the company, and no notification is sent to the doorbell's owner. In our scenario, the dangerous actor will continue to see time-stamped photos of everyone who comes and goes. And if he chooses to share that serial number with other individuals, or even post it online, all those people will be able to monitor the images too. If you own one of these doorbells, Consumer Reports recommend that you disconnect it from your home Wi-Fi and remove it from your door. CR has evaluated video doorbells with much better security from brands including Logitech, SimpliSafe, and Ring, which is actually owned by Amazon. More broadly, don't assume that large online retail platforms have evaluated the safety of all the products they sell. Federal agencies and journalists have reported a variety of dangerous or illegal products for sale on Amazon over the years. Meanwhile, Consumer Reports is asking online retailers to take steps to guarantee the quality of the products available on their platforms. CR has also advocated for legislation to make online platforms strictly liable for selling defective products and push for laws that make it clear that retailers need to take reasonable steps to keep harmful, fraudulent, or insecure products off their platforms. And we shared our findings about video doorbells with the Federal Trade Commission, which has the power to remove products like these from the marketplace. The agency declined to comment on what action it might take, noting that its investigations are private. So the bottom line here, other than the obvious one that's spelled out in this article, is be very careful about buying unknown brands. And I've seen this a lot when I'm on Amazon. When you go search for, let's say I was looking for a video doorbell, and you search for video doorbell on Amazon, and you get a long list of devices, and it doesn't take long to look at some of those devices and think, that really looks just like the other one. Like, the photos are the same, even though the brand is different, or sometimes the seller looks different. It becomes pretty obvious pretty fast that a lot of these devices were all manufactured by the same person and just have different labels on them. I would say that that is almost always a red flag. I can't think of any case where that has ever been a good thing. So anyway, just know that when you're buying a lot of these products, especially these really cheap products from overseas, that the security in these things is either non-existent or just horrible. And when these products have access to your network, if they're IoT devices, or if they have cameras or microphones in them, they could be serious, serious privacy and security risks. Stick to name brands, spend the extra money on companies that have a good reputation and therefore a desire to maintain that reputation. All right, moving on. This is from NPR. A student project has revealed yet another power of artificial intelligence. It can be extremely good at geolocating where photos are taken. The project, known as Predicting Image Geolocation, or PIGEON for short, was designed by three Stanford graduate students in order to identify locations on Google Street View. But when presented with a few personal photos that it had never seen before, the program was, in the majority of cases, able to make accurate guesses about where the photos were taken. Like so many applications of AI, this new power is likely to be a double-edged sword. It may help people identify the locations of old snapshots from relatives, or allow field biologists to conduct rapid surveys of entire regions for invasive plant species, to name but a few of many likely beneficial applications. But it could also be used to expose information about individuals that they never intended to share, says Jay Stanley, a senior policy analyst at the American Civil Liberties Union who studies technology. Stanley worries that similar technology, which he feels will almost certainly become widely available, could be used for government surveillance, corporate tracking, or even stalking. The Stanford students trained their version of the system with images from Google Street View. And this is a quote from one of the students, quote, "We created our own data set of around 500,000 Street View images. That's actually not that much data, and we were able to get quite spectacular performance," unquote. The team added additional pieces to the program, including one that helped the AI classify images by their position on the globe. When completed, the PIGEON system could identify the location of a Google Street View image anywhere on Earth. It guessed the correct country 95% of the time and can usually pick a location within about 25 miles of the actual site. Stanley worries that companies might soon use AI to track where you've traveled, or the governments might check your photos to see if you visited a country on a watch list. Stalking and abuse are also obvious threats, he says. In the past, Stanley says, people have been able to remove GPS location tagging from photos they post online. That may not work anymore. The Stanford graduate students are well aware of the risks. They've written a paper on their technique, which they co-authored along with their professor, Chelsea Finn, but they've held back from making their full model publicly available precisely because of these concerns, they said. But Stanley thinks the use of AI for geolocation will become even more powerful going forward. He doubts there's much to be done, except to be aware of what's in the background of the photos that you post online. So yeah, I mean, I think that pretty much says it. So I've always told you to be careful about what you post online, to be thinking about how the information that's in that photo could be abused, like taking a picture of your house where it might have the address in it, or taking a picture of your kids at school that might have the name of the school in the background, or the park that they're visiting, or street signs. In addition to the GPS coordinates that are often saved in the EXIF, the EXIF metadata that's often associated with photos. Now, Facebook in particular, I think, says that it removes that EXIF information, though it probably saves it for itself before it posts your pictures online. But you should just be aware that that information is there, and you might want to scrub the EXIF information from your photos before you post them online. And also just now be aware of what is in the background of your photos. If there's enough detail in the photo, even if it's not a street sign, even if it's not even necessarily a landmark, though that would be a big one. These AI programs are getting to the point where they can identify where these pictures were taken. Think of Google Street View. So Google Street View is a service with Google Maps that allows you to point at a spot on a map and say, okay, tell me what it looks like if I was standing right here. And it will give you a 360-degree view of what it would look like if you were standing right there. And obviously, that's going to include things like houses and cars and things. I think Google does try to blur out license plate numbers. And you can actually ask Google to blur out your house on Street Views if you want, but by default, it won't be. But if you have access to all these photos and you know where every one of these photos was taken, then you could do what these guys have done and create AI programs that find similar backgrounds to figure out where that photo was taken. So be thinking about this as you're uploading your photos, and also realize that this can be done on all the existing photos that you have already uploaded. So be sure to restrict the viewing of your social media posts. Try not to post, you know, to everybody whenever you can help it. Just, you know, maybe at least try to post only to friends. And knowing what we know now and knowing that it's only going to get better or worse, depending on how you look at this, the technology will only get better and the privacy risks will get worse. You may want to start thinking about closing accounts you don't use anymore. And before you do, I would ask them to delete the data that they have on you. Because just deleting, or in a lot of cases, they don't even call it deleting. They call it deactivating or turning off or pausing, or they get, you know, all sorts of dark pattern, you know, things instead of that. They don't want you to close it. They just want you to pause it. That probably won't delete your data. So if the upshot of you trying to turn these accounts off is that you want this data to no longer be available, you're probably going to have to explicitly ask them to delete your data first. Okay, next up, this is from Ars Technica. Canada-based University of Waterloo is racing to remove M&M-branded smart vending machines from campus after outraged students discovered the machines were covertly collecting facial recognition data without their consent. The scandal started when a student using the alias SquidKid47 posted an image on Reddit showing a campus vending machine error message. And the error message was invenda.vending.facialrecognitionapp.exe. Displayed after the machine failed to launch a facial recognition application that nobody expected to be part of the process of using a vending machine. The Reddit post sparked an investigation from a fourth-year student named River Stanley, who was writing for the university publication called Math News. Stanley sounded the alarm after consulting Invenda sales brochures that promised, quote, the machines are capable of sending estimated ages and genders, unquote, of every person who used the machines without ever requesting their consent. This frustrated Stanley, who discovered that Canada's privacy commissioner had years ago investigated a shopping mall operator called Cadillac Fairview after discovering some of the mall's information kiosks were secretly using facial recognition software on unsuspecting patrons. Only because of that official investigation did Canadians learn that over 5 million non-consenting Canadians were scanned into Cadillac Fairview's database, Stanley reported. Where Cadillac Fairview was ultimately forced to delete the entire database, Stanley wrote that consequences for collecting similarly sensitive facial recognition data without consent for Invenda clients like Mars remain unclear. Stanley's report ended with a call for students to demand that the university bar facial recognition vending machines from campus. A University of Waterloo spokesperson, Rebecca Elming, eventually responded, confirming to CTV News that the school had asked to disable the vending machine software until the machines could be removed. I think this is happening a lot more than we suspect it is. This is just super easy to do now. These cameras are very tiny. You can hide them anywhere. And in this case, it sounds like what they were doing is not necessarily identifying people, but trying to get some demographics about the type of people who are using it, at what times, how often, things like that. Analytics, basically. But they were doing it without the consent or knowledge of the users of these vending machines. They probably assumed that since they weren't trying to actually identify people, that there was no privacy problem here, and therefore notice and consent weren't required. In the U.S., by law, that's that's probably true. But it won't be long before, you know, these things are all networked and some other company comes along and says, hey, I know you've already got these webcams built into all these vending machines. We will pay you to give us access to that feed, and then they'll start using it for other purposes. It's just crazy. And it's getting crazier, and we've got to put a lid on this because it's gotten totally out of control. All right, next up, this is from the markup, and it, again, kind of dovetails with this data collection. In 2021, a company specializing in collecting and selling location data called NEAR, N-E-A-R, and we've talked about them not that long ago. I can't remember which interview this came up in, but it wasn't long ago. Bragged that it was the world's largest data set of people's behavior in the real world, with data representing 1.6 billion people across 44 countries. Last year, the company went public with a valuation of $1 billion. And 7 months later, it filed for bankruptcy and has agreed to sell the company. But for the 1.6 billion people that Near said its database represents, the important question is, what happens to Near's mountain of location data? Any company could gain access to it through the purchasing of the company's assets. The prospect of this data, including Near's collection of location data from sensitive locations, such as abortion clinics, being sold off in bankruptcy, raised alarms in Congress. Last week, Senator Ron Wyden, there's that name again, wrote the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, urging the agency to protect consumers and investors from the outrageous conduct of Near, citing his office's investigation into the India-based company. Wyden's letter also urged the FTC to intervene in Near's bankruptcy proceedings to ensure that all location and device data held by Near about Americans is promptly destroyed and is not sold off, including to another data broker. The FTC took such an action in 2010 to block the use of 11 years' worth of subscriber personal data during the bankruptcy proceedings of XY Magazine, which was oriented to young gay men. The agency requested that the data be destroyed to prevent its misuse. According to Near's privacy policy, all the data they have collected can be transferred to the new owners. Under the heading of "Who do you share my personal data with?", it lists prospective buyers of our business. This type of clause is common in privacy policies and is a regular part of businesses being bought and sold. Where it gets complicated is when the company being sold owns data containing sensitive information. This week, a new bankruptcy court filing showed that Wyden's requests were granted. The order placed restrictions on the use, sale, licensing, or transfer of location data collected from sensitive location in the United States and requires any company that purchases the data to establish a sensitive location data program with detailed policies for such data and ensure ongoing monitoring and compliance, including the creation of a list of sensitive locations such as reproductive health care facilities, doctor's offices, houses of worship, mental health care providers, corrections facilities, and shelters, among others. The order demands that unless consumers have explicitly provided consent, the company must cease any collection, use, or transfer of location data. The bankruptcy order also provided a rare glimpse into how data brokers license data to one another. Near's list of contracts included agreements with several location brokers, ad platforms, universities, retailers, and city governments. So as I've often said, it's not just a matter of whether or not you trust the company that is collecting your data. It's whether or not you collect all the quote-unquote partners that they may be sharing it with. And then what happens to that data should that company go out of business and be sold or go through bankruptcy or get transferred to another company? I mean, if you're going under, if your company is fire sailing everything, that data can be worth a lot of money. And that company's creditors and shareholders are going to want you to maximize the value of that data so they can try to get some of their initial investment back. So at least in this case, it looks like, you know, they kind of caught it in time, hopefully, and put a stop to potential abuses of that data. But what we really need is some sort of, I don't know, blanket law that prevents this from happening in any such case. So, speaking of data, this is a Lifehacker article, and it's called "All Your Information That's Publicly Available and What You Can Do About It." And this article doesn't say this, but this is often what we refer to as OSINT, or open source intelligence. There happens to be a lot of what you might think of very personal information out there about you that are quote unquote public records or can be scraped from public sites and aggregated and then sold. So let me read you this article. It's one thing to be vaguely aware that privacy no longer really exists. We live in a world filled with doorbell cameras, so your chances of turning up in random TikToks or YouTube videos are never zero after all. But most people assume that there's a clear line between what we consider our personal business and the information available in public records. But the truth is that line isn't much of a line at all. You don't have to be a billionaire with a private jet to experience the joys of public records. And by the way, that was a link, I'm sure, to an article about either Elon Musk or Taylor Swift, who are famous people whose private jets are being tracked because it's information that's publicly available. And somebody has gone to the trouble of plotting these out on the map and publishing it to social media, much to the chagrin of these famous people. Anyway, back to the article. If you've ever Googled an old school friend out of curiosity, you've probably gotten a bunch of results back from sites like Spokio or White Pages, promising to generate a report that lists everything about that person. Maybe you thought it was a scam, but those sites can actually offer you a ton of information of just about anyone, but there's a lot more information about you in public and publicly accessible records than you might think. So what's in public records? A lot. The basics, your name, birthday, home address, certainly. But also most probably stuff like your driver's license number and status, your social security number, traffic fines and accidents, your voter registration, your marital status, your home address, employment history, your photo and physical description, the names of your immediate relatives, spouse, and children, property records including liens, foreclosures, and mortgages, and arrest records. Some of this is obvious. If you've ever maintained a LinkedIn profile, your work history, photo, and contact info is likely scraped and repackaged. If you list your home for sale, everyone in your neighborhood can know about it immediately when your house shows up on Trulia or Zillow. But you might imagine that things you don't voluntarily post online would remain private. For example, if you get into financial trouble and your home is foreclosed on, you're probably not posting that to Facebook with a frowny face emoji, so you might expect it to remain private. But you'd be wrong. If someone wants to know if you are in a foreclosure or on your home, it's very easy to find all that information too. By triangulating mortgage, foreclosure, and court records, you can assemble a pretty clear picture of someone's financial state without violating a single law. One reason this is so easy? The government is actively selling your information via that beloved institution, the DMV. In order to obtain a driver's license, you have to submit a lot of personal information to your state's Department of Motor Vehicles or equivalent, and they actively and enthusiastically sell that information to third parties. That alone makes it insanely easy to find out most of this stuff, and anything classified as a public record is legally accessible by anyone, otherwise it wouldn't be considered public. So details about your life are in public records. What can you do about that? Not a ton. Agencies like the DMV aren't going to scrub your personal data because they need that to perform their function, and they're not going to stop selling your data until the laws change. And once information from social media is scraped, there's no way to unscrape it. But there are a few things you could do to remove private information from at least some public records. It goes through a little bit of a list here, and I'm just going to very quickly tick these off. For people search sites, you can request that your information be removed. You've got to find them all, and then you've got to go through this really arcane process. I tried this a couple times myself. It didn't really work. They removed it, and then a few months later, it popped right back up. I had asked them to remove it again. It's a real pain in the butt. Also, you can remove your unused profiles. In other words, social media accounts, if you're not using these things. I just talked about this a minute ago. You can delete the data and then delete the account or try to. For your own records, of course, you might want to get a copy of that data first if you can. Now, for government sites and banks and so on, you usually can't delete your data, but in some cases, you can ask them to hide certain aspects of it. Sometimes you can, depending on your locality, because there's no laws around this, and that's part of the problem. So you can ask them to, in some cases, like obscure your voter registration information. Like I mentioned before, you can go to Google and say you want them to blur your house on Google Street View. But again, this involves going to each of these individual places once you find them and asking them to do this, and it's a real pain in the butt. There are sites that purport to help you delete all this information kind of in bulk, which really means that you contract them to do this and they go out, because they're now professionals at doing this, and they find, you know, all these major sites that have this information and try to delete it on your behalf for a fee. You know, Delete Me is probably one you've heard of. There are others like Incogni or Privacy Bee. There's another one you may not have heard of called Easy Opt Outs. Just FYI, I'm going to be doing a tip of the week on this sometime soon. I'm planning to try one or two of these out myself and then write an article about it. So stay tuned on that. Okay, now for a little bit of a lightning round, I have a few good stories for you. Most of these are very short. First of all, Privacy for Cars posted this on their social media, and I followed up on it. And it's a great instance of, I'm sure, work behind the things they're doing actually causing good in the world. And this happens to be a brand new law in New Jersey here in the States. And I'm actually going to read you from an executive summary from the New Jersey government site. And it's a letter to dealerships in New Jersey. And it says, in January 2024, New Jersey Governor Murphy signed and made effective immediately the Motor Vehicle Data Deletion Act. And this law requires, quote, Whenever a motor vehicle dealer takes possession of a motor vehicle from a consumer for the purposes of resale or lease, the motor vehicle dealer shall offer to delete the consumer's personal information from the motor vehicle's computer system in the motor vehicle, including but not limited to navigation history, paired phones, and garage door codes by performing data clearing protocols in accordance with the Guidelines for Media Sanitization developed by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, using techniques specified by the vehicle manufacturer to overwrite data or by using a menu option to reset the device to original factory settings. Not doing so will incur a civil penalty of $500 for the first time and $1,000 for subsequent offenses, unquote. The law provides dealers the opportunity to charge a reasonable fee for services performed in connection with the requirements of this section. The dealer shall disclose the fee to the consumer prior to performing the service and shall advise the consumer that the consumer may attempt to delete the personal information themselves or through another vendor. We urge you to immediately contact your New Jersey locations to ensure they have the proper processes, safeguards, and compliance monitoring systems necessary to comply with this law. Yay. Thank goodness. And hats off to Andre Amico. I'm sure somehow, some way, Privacy for Cars was instrumental in seeing that this happened. And hopefully we'll start seeing more of this across the country. And who knows, maybe federally. Next up, Lifehacker tells us about Proton Mail having a handy email aliasing service. And this was bound to happen since they bought Simple Login, which that's what Simple Login does, is create email aliases. So I'm not surprised that this is here, but I want you to let you know. And so the article says, Proton Mail is one of the best alternatives to Gmail, Outlook, and Apple Mail out there, with end-to-end encryption, tracker blocking, and phishing protection among the features on offer. A free account gets you a gigabyte of storage and up to 150 messages per day, while paid plans start at $3.99 per month. The latest feature to be added to Proton Mail is the option to hide your email address. That's where you set up an email alias to provide when you buy something or sign up for a social media service while keeping your actual email address private. It's something already available on other email clients like Apple's. Apple already has a feature like this, and a lot of other email services are now offering this. And you can get it set up in just a few minutes. Here's how email aliases work and why you should be using them. And by the way, I wrote two whole blog articles about this on Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons. If you want to go search for them, I talked about them recently, but here's the brief version here. When you're filling out a web form, signing up for a new digital service, or telling someone how to get in touch with you, you start by generating an alias inside your email app, and then you use the alias as opposed to your actual email address when you're filling out a web form, signing up for a new digital service, or telling someone how to get in touch with you. Any messages sent to that alias drop in your regular inbox. Apps and sites and web forums are always demanding email addresses out of us, and an alias system adds a bit of extra protection and privacy, as well as some additional control over your inbox. You can create an email alias for a specific purpose, like organizing a soccer team, for example, and then filter all the messages that come into that alias. The other big advantage of using an email alias is you can ditch it at any time. If you want to stop subscribing to a streaming service, you can retire the email address associated with it too. Or if a company is sending you too much spam, you could simply delete the alias you gave them out of existence. If you use separate aliases for everything you sign up to, you'll also know which companies are sending you too many messages and which aren't, and potentially which companies are selling you out to some data broker. If you're on a paid Proton plan, you can create as many email aliases as you like, while free account users get up to 10 of them. Log in to Proton Mail on the web, then click the shield icon in the sidebar on the right, it'll say Security Center when you hover over it, and click Create an Alias to do just that. The dialog that then pops up lets you specify a name for the alias. It's a good idea to use a name that indicates what the alias is for to help you keep track of them. This name is then added to a randomly generated string of text and numbers, which is your actual alias. You're also able to add a note to the alias to help you remember why you created it. Click the Create and Copy Alias and you're done. You can paste your newly created disposable email address into whatever website or app you're registering with. To get to your aliases and delete any that you no longer need, just click on the shield icon again inside Proton Mail, then the All Aliases link. So I've really been pushing this technology hard recently because so many sites now are requiring you to use an email address. Even free sites, even sites that you don't really need to interact with, are now asking you for an email address. And beyond what this article talks about, again, for privacy reasons, most of us only have one or two email addresses, right? So they now also use these usernames or email addresses to track us from site to site and to know that we are the same person on these different sites, and they can correlate that information. So if you give them aliases of all these websites have different email addresses for you, even though it only comes to a single inbox for you, they don't necessarily know that each of those addresses is you. So that is a good thing. So again, I wrote up a couple articles on this and with more information and different ways you could do this on firewallsdontstopdragons.com. All right, another report out of Canada. This is from CBC. And it's about a ruling from the Canadian Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of Canada made a key privacy ruling Friday, and this, I think, was March 1st, that means police must now first have a warrant or a court order to obtain the numbers making up a person or organization's IP address. The top court was asked to consider whether an IP address alone, without any of the personal information attached to it, was protected by an expectation of privacy under the Charter. In a 5-4 split decision, the court said a reasonable expectation of privacy is attached to the numbers making up a person's IP address, and just getting those numbers alone constitutes a search. Writing for the majority, this justice, whose name I will not try to pronounce, wrote that an IP address is the crucial link between an internet user and their online activity. Thus, the subject matter of this search was the information these IP addresses could reveal about specific internet users, including, ultimately, their identity. So another yay, that is a good thing. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that in the U.S. that is not required. A warrant is not required. A subpoena is sufficient to go to an ISP, an internet service provider, to get someone's IP address. But again, I'm not a lawyer, and I do hope that at some point we have laws around this sort of stuff that will protect that information. But currently, I do not believe that we do. So this is a welcome decision for those north of our border. Congratulations. All right, now I've got a couple of quick articles here about spyware firms. This was first one's from Hacker News. The U.S. Department of Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, sanctioned two individuals and five entities associated with Intellexa Alliance for their role in developing, operating, and distributing commercial spyware designed to target government officials, journalists, and policy experts in the country. The proliferation, and this is a quote from the agency, quote, "The proliferation of commercial spyware poses distinct and growing security risks to the United States and has been misused by foreign actors to enable human rights abuses and the targeting of dissidents around the world for oppression and reprisal. The Intellexa Consortium, which has a global customer base, has enabled the proliferation of commercial spyware and surveillance technologies around the world, including to authoritarian regimes," unquote. The Intellexa Alliance is a consortium of several companies, including Cytrox, linked to a mercenary spyware solution called Predator. In July 2023, the U.S. government added Cytrox and Intellexa, as well as their corporate holdings in Hungary, Greece, and Ireland, to the quote-unquote entity list. Predator, much like NSO Group's Pegasus, can infiltrate Android and iOS devices using zero-click attacks that require no user interaction. Once installed, the spyware makes it possible for the operators to harvest sensitive data and surveil targets of interest. OFAC said unspecified foreign actors had deployed Predator against U.S. government officials, journalists, and policy experts. And this is the quote from the Treasury Department, quote, "In the event of a successful Predator infection, the spyware's operators can access and retrieve sensitive information, including contacts, call logs, and messaging information, microphone recordings, and the media from the device," unquote. The sanctions targeting the makers of Predator also arrived after the U.S. government unveiled a new policy last month that will allow it to impose visa restrictions on foreign individuals involved in the misuse of commercial spyware. Citizen Lab security researcher John Scott Railton described the OFAC designations as a huge deal, stating that they mark the, quote, "first time they're used against a mercenary spyware company," unquote. And let me lead this right into the next news story from 9to5Mac about a serious setback for the NSO Group, which makes Pegasus, which should lead to some very interesting news stories down the line. And they say, the Android and iPhone spyware company NSO has suffered a major defeat in a U.S. court after a judge ruled that the company must hand over its Pegasus code to Meta. And again, Meta is Facebook. It's the latest setback for the company, which has been blacklisted in the U.S., sued by Apple, seen victims alerted by the iPhone maker and faced several financial problems. NSO is an Israeli company best known for its Pegasus spyware, which can be used to remotely hack an iPhone. Simply receiving a particular iMessage without opening it or interacting with it in any way can allow an iPhone to be compromised with almost all the personal data on it exposed. The U.S. government banned the use and import of Pegasus, depriving the company of its most lucrative customer base, U.S. law enforcement agencies. Apple added to the pressure, suing the company and alerting owners of infected iPhones. That put the company under extreme financial pressure, which may see it disappear, or may just make things worse. And that's a link to another article, basically, which says that if this company, kind of like what I was talking about earlier, if this company starts going under and is under this financial pressure, it may start selling this spyware to, you know, countries that it otherwise said it wouldn't have. It basically has long said that we only sell this with the approval of the Israeli government and only to quote unquote good guys. But if they can't sell to the good guys anymore and they need to make money and stay afloat, then this article basically is saying that they may start selling to the quote unquote bad guys. For those most at risk, such as diplomats, politicians, government opponents, and activists, Apple has made available iPhone lockdown mode, which disables the most common attack paths. In addition to attacking iPhones, Pegasus also has exploits for specific apps, including WhatsApp, which is owned by Meta/Facebook. Meta discovered back in 2019 that the spyware had been used against around 1,400 WhatsApp users and launched a lawsuit against the company. As part of the case, Meta demanded that NSO hand over the code for Pegasus and reveal its full functionality. NSO naturally refused, but The Guardian reports that a judge has now ruled in favor of Meta. NSO Group, the maker of one of the world's most sophisticated cyber weapons, has been ordered by a U.S. court to hand its code for Pegasus and other spyware products to WhatsApp as part of the company's ongoing litigation. The decision by Judge Phyllis Hamilton is a major legal victory for WhatsApp, the Meta-owned communication app which has been embroiled in a lawsuit against NSO since 2019. She sided with WhatsApp in ordering the company to produce all relevant spyware for a period of 1 year before and after the 2 weeks in which the WhatsApp users were allegedly attacked. This says 2 weeks here. I think they mean 2 years because the period covers April 2018 to May of 2020. NSO must also give WhatsApp information concerning the full functionality of the relevant spyware. The lawsuit itself will continue once NSO has complied. So that's interesting. I don't know if they're going to be able to appeal that ruling or not, but I'm sure that we're going to learn some interesting things from this. I mean, I don't know. It's probably covered under some sort of secrecy thing and a legal thing. I don't know. But my hope is that once Meta gets a hold of this, we are somehow, maybe through whistleblowers or whatever, going to learn a lot more about what these guys do. All right. Last very, very short news thing that will lead into my tip of the week. And this is from The Verge, and it's titled Authius Shutting Down Its Desktop App. Authy, the two-factor authentication or 2FA app, will soon only be available on mobile devices. An updated support page spotted by Bleeping Computer said Authy's app on Windows, macOS, and Linux will go away in August of 2024. Similar to other 2FA apps like Google Authenticator and Microsoft Authenticator, Authy generates a different code every 30 seconds that you can use to sign in to a linked account. However, Authy is one of the only 2FA apps available for desktop, making it an ideal choice when you want to sign into an account on your computer without having to get out your phone. If you have a Mac with an M1 or M2 silicon, or M3 now, Authy says you'll still be able to download the iOS version of the app on your device. In other words, the Apple Silicon-based Mac computers have the capability of running iOS apps directly under macOS. So basically, you can still do this with the iOS version of the Authy app. Otherwise, Authy recommends switching to the mobile version instead, which you can automatically sync with your app on your computer. And by the way, if you don't already have one on your mobile device, you should do it soon so that you can use this syncing mechanism to get all the codes from your desktop app onto your mobile device. And that's one of the reasons that made me think about doing this as my tip of the week, which I'll get to in just 1 second. Anyway, if you'd rather switch apps altogether, it's worth noting that Authy doesn't come with an export feature. And that's horrible. That means you'll have to disable 2FA on all of your connected accounts before linking them with a new 2FA app. Right. So that brings me to this week's tip of the week. And it's about backing up your two-factor authentication codes. So let's review just briefly. Two-factor authentication is belt and suspenders, as we like to say. It's you've got your password as your main method for authenticating yourself to a service. And a lot of services now offer the ability to have a second mechanism, a second thing that you need to go through in order to fully access your account. And that is to provide this two-factor authentication code. And this is really, really important. Until we can move 100% to something like pass keys, it's really, really important that you protect your most sensitive accounts with this belt and suspenders methodology, with having two things required to get in. So that if for some reason somebody either guesses your password or finds a way to bypass that first authentication mechanism, they now have a second thing, a second barrier they need to get to access your account. That's this second factor authentication. And we call it two-factor authentication because generally when you authenticate, we like to say that it's one of three things. It's something you have, something you know, or something that you are. So something you have, it might be a badge or your phone in a lot of cases, like this one, or maybe a hardware key like a YubiKey. Something you know is the password. That's the thing we're all used to now. That's the one factor that everybody is used to. But for your most crucial accounts, you really want a second factor of some sort. And then something you are is kind of like biometrics. That is, eye scan, fingerprint scan, face scan, that sort of thing. So two-factor authentication is the something you know. That's the thing. That's the password thing we're all used to. And adding something else to that, a second thing. In this case, it's an app that generates every 30 seconds a different six-digit PIN code. Now, some sites and services still require you to use SMS or text for these codes. You get a text message with this code in it. That is way better than nothing, but SMS is just really not that secure. If you have the opportunity to do so, you should use an authenticator app. A lot of these services will say explicitly to use Google Authenticator. It doesn't have to be Google Authenticator, though. All of these services have the same underlying technology called TOTP, which stands for time-based one-time password. It's a standard that they all use. So if anything says it can use Google Authenticator, think of it like Kleenex. If it says you can use Kleenex, then you can also use some off-brand tissue as well. It's a standard. So go to these sites. You say you want to set up two-factor authentication. The way it usually works is that it pops up a QR code for you to scan with the Authenticator app, and this allows them to synchronize. This QR code represents what we call a seed code, S-E-E-D, seed code. Sometimes it will actually show you the text that QR code is representing. That they're the same thing. It's just a different representation. The QR code is easier because you can use your phone's camera app to scan that to get the code instead of having to type it in. But you could also just type it in as well. So the key though is once you set up two-factor authentication, you've got this great security. But if all those seed codes only live in the app on your phone and you lose your phone or it's stolen, you are now locked out of those accounts because you no longer have the something you have, your phone in this case, you no longer have that device to satisfy the second step in two-factor authentication. Now, most of these services don't ask you for two-factor authentication all the time. Usually they only kind of do it when they sense something is different, like it's the first time in a long time that you've logged in, or you're logged in from an odd location, like maybe a different country, or you're using a new device, you're logged in from a different device. There are various things that trigger this, and that's proprietary how they decide to do that. But you're not always required to do the two-factor, but as soon as you're required to do that and you don't no longer have the device, you're going to be locked out. So you need some way to back up these codes. Now, here's the problem. I've recommended Authy for a long time, and that's one reason I'm talking about this article, because it's something I've recommended to my audience in my book and elsewhere. It is very handy. It actually has a cloud sync backup, which is one of the reasons I originally picked it, because Google Authenticator didn't, meaning that there was no easy way for you to back up your codes to another device. With Authy, you can set up an online account, and it will securely sync between all of your devices your seed codes. The problem is, with this app and many others like them, is that they don't allow you to see those seed codes later. You can't even bring them up to see them and hand copy them, let alone export them in bulk. And that's on purpose. And it's really crappy that they do this. And I can't believe in this day and age that they still get away with this, especially with a third-party app like an Authy. They really should give you this opportunity, because that locks you into their app from then on. Because now all your codes are in there, and even if they're synchronized to all your devices, you can't go to some other Authenticator app, you couldn't go to Google Authenticator. You can't go to Aegis or ENTE, some of the ones I might recommend you try. You can't go to those other ones because you can't easily export your codes. So while having that cloud sync to another device of some sort, and it can't be your desktop anymore, unless you're in this weird case with an iOS running on an Apple Silicon app, you can't synchronize across devices. So if you only have it on one device and you lose that device, you're still in trouble. You need some way to back these codes up. What I have done and what I do is whenever I set up two-factor authentication, this is the easy button. Whenever I set up two-factor authentication, I print the page that has the QR code on it and sometimes the printed seed code on it. The QR code is sufficient. I just print them on a physical piece of paper and I make sure I write down on that piece of paper what it is if it's not clear from the printout, which service that is that corresponds to, and just put that in a very safe place. If necessary, at any point, I can always go back and scan that again to reset up my two-factor authentication for that account without actually having to go to the service and reset up officially two-factor authentication. That seed code is all you ever need. From now until forever, as long as you can scan that seed code, you can generate the right PIN codes for your two-factor authentication. In fact, I've seen people use this with their spouse, for example. Let's say you've got a shared account and you want both of you on your phones to have access to the code. Well, if you had printed that code off when you set it up for yourself, you could take it to your wife and say, oh, you want access to this too? Just scan this with your two-factor authentication app, whatever it is, Google Authenticator, Authy, whatever. And because you have scanned the same seed code, both of your devices will now generate the same six-digit codes at the same time. That's how it works. So by the same token, as long as you have that piece of paper, if you lose your device, you're fine. Get yourself a brand new phone. You don't have to sync anything. Just bring up a new app and go through each of those paper printouts you have and re-add all your accounts, and they'll work just fine. Now, you could also, if they show you the QR code, they'll either show you the little text version of that seed code underneath it, or sometimes you have to click a link to expose it. But that text-based code is identical. It serves the same purpose. If you want to save that code somewhere securely, you could save all those codes somewhere too. It might, maybe that's easier for you depending on how you want to save this stuff. For example, you could put it in a password-protected text file if you wish. And you absolutely should be protecting that file in some way. Don't just make it a completely open file. It should be encrypted or password protected somehow. You could also set up a folder on your computer, and I would make sure that folder is backed up, but set up an encrypted folder, maybe using Cryptomator or a Veracrypt or something like that to have an encrypted folder, and you could copy all the images of the QR codes into that if you wish. Again, just make sure that's backed up securely somehow. If you happen to have a second device, I don't know, for some reason you've got another device that's not linked to the same account, you could start up another app. Maybe you've got an iPad or something and you want to use a different authenticator. You could scan the code on that too and kind of keep a backup that way yourself, sort of. You could theoretically put these into your password manager, and some password managers actually now have this as a kind of a feature that they tout. You could use like Bitwarden. Bitwarden has a TOTP authenticator app that you could use, and it saves the code in your vault with Bitwarden. Which is convenient. You've already got a secure cloud-based service for your passwords. Why not also use that for your seed codes for 2FA? But it kind of puts all your eggs in one basket. The threat model against that is a little different. You could still argue that it's fairly secure that way. But if you recall the LastPass hack, where the hackers actually got a hold of people's encrypted vaults and have been spending time trying to crack those vaults, if somebody were to somehow get a hold of your vault and get into your vault, then they would have everything they need to get into all your accounts. So I personally like to keep them separate. Now you could get, there's a lot of password managers out there. You could use, for example, Bitwarden for all your passwords, and then you could get 1Password or Dashlane or some other open source one like KeePass. And maybe you could kind of use that separately for your seed codes if you wanted to kind of keep them separate that way. That's something you could think about doing. But you really do need backups. Even if you use Authy that has a cloud backup, what if Authy goes out of business? You should still have access to all the information that's on your phone, but it's always best to have an independent backup if you can. So it's really bad, by the way, that Authy, and I don't think Google Authenticator allows this either, or I don't know if LastPass does, but a lot of these companies with their authenticator apps don't allow you to save these kind of yourself. You can't export all your codes in an easy fashion to back them up yourself. And that's just crappy. There are some that are open source or other apps that are better about this. You can look at Aegis, which is AEGIS for Android. There's another one that's kind of new that I have not tried out called Ente, E-N-T-E, and that is available for iOS and Android. These do allow you to export your code, so if you're starting from scratch, you might want to look at those first. But if you are using Authy, and you don't mind getting your hands dirty a little bit with some command line stuff, there are several projects, and I've listed one of them in the article I'm going to write about this for the blog article, that will let you, from the Mac desktop Authy app, I think it's the Mac one, it might be for Windows as well. Basically, if you use the right version of the app, and you've got to go back a couple of versions, because it only works with a slightly older version of the desktop app, there are command line utilities that know how to extract your seed codes from that app while it's running. Now, that app's not going to be supported much longer, so if you're going to do that, you need to do this before August. There's a link in the show notes if you want to do that. I'm not going to try to describe it anymore here. But now you're thinking, okay, Cary, that's great if I haven't already set up my two-factor authentication codes, but I've already set up my two-factor authentication codes, and I use an app that doesn't allow me to export them, so now what do I do? Well, unfortunately, the only real way for you to do this after the fact, because you can't go to these services that you've set up two-factor authentication and have them show you your seed code again in most cases, you're really kind of stuck. You're probably going to have to turn off two-factor authentication on each of those accounts and then re-enable it, basically start over. So if you've got a lot of them, that could be painful. And, you know, just set a schedule, work yourself through them over time. Start with the most important ones first. You'll have to go to that account, turn off two-factor authentication for that service, which will require you to have the two-factor authentication device on hand. So you need a PIN code to do it. So turn off two-factor authentication and then turn it back on. And at that point, when you turn it back on, you could take a picture of the page. You could do all these things I'm talking about where you could capture the seed code. Or if you move to a new service like Aegis or Ente, then you will know that at any point you can export those yourself. You know, and I would just use this opportunity to switch to one of those apps that will allow you to do that, and that will allow you to back them up periodically. So there you have it, folks. There is your news and your tip of the week. Next week, we're going to have my interview with Kate Black. We're going to talk about medical data privacy. Very interesting subject. Something I've been wanting to talk about as an interview topic for a while now. Very soon, I'm going to be talking with Joe Mullen from the EFF about the Kids Online Safety Act. I also talked to Justin and Jody Daniels about basically all things privacy. That was a fun talk. And then I'm working on my mailbag episode. I'm going to have that pre-recorded and 100% dedicated to all the Dear Cary questions that you guys sent. And obviously with my answers to those questions. So that's all coming up. If you want to make sure you don't miss any of that, then you'll need to subscribe. And then you'll be sure to get it every week. Also, if you like these tips of the week and you like the full versions of these, you can go to my blog at firewallsdontstopdragons.com. You can see all the ones I've done in the past, or you can just make a point of going there every so often to read them. If you want to make sure you get them, you can sign up for my newsletter. They're almost always the same, and you'll get it every 2 weeks right in your inbox. If you go to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons, you'll see you can click the link there for the newsletter to sign up. Okay, everybody, that's going to do it for this week. Take care, stay safe out there, and until next week, as always, don't get caught with your garbage down.